This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We've all heard that saying about real estate. It all comes down to location, location, and then location, right? But that works both ways. We learned this morning housing in some places is doing okay. In too many others, though, it's really not. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 29th of December, and it is good to have you with us. You know, a couple of years ago, while he was still running the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan made a speech about the U.S. housing market and how what we had wasn't necessarily a bubble. It was just a market that had a lot of froth in it. That was his word, froth. Different things going on in different places. Well, you know, that works on the way down as well as on the way up. After 5 months of gains, the Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Index was basically flat when it came out this morning. Of the 20 cities whose home prices are measured in that index, less than half of them saw prices rise in October over a month earlier. Our New York Bureau Chief, Amy Scott, has the story.
Each city in the Case-Shiller Index tells a different story about the housing market. Maureen Maitland is vice president of index services at Standard & Poor's. She says prices in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego have been rising for several months.
The counter to that has been Las Vegas. Las Vegas has been down for more than 3 years and continues to trade down. It's, in fact, the one city that hasn't shown any positive movement at all in 2009.
The downturn hit later in Portland and Seattle, so they're still seeing big price drops from a year ago. Overall, though, Maitland says home prices are stabilizing. Consultant Thomas Lawler credits a slew of government programs like tax breaks for home buyers and efforts by the Federal Reserve to keep mortgage rates low.
And when you add all of that up, that's had an enormous impact on stabilizing the market.
But some of those programs are winding down, and some analysts are expecting a double dip in home prices. By the end of March, the Fed plans to stop buying mortgage-backed securities from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which has helped suppress interest rates. The tax credits for homebuyers expire in April. Stan Humphries is chief economist at Zillow.com, a real estate website. He's predicting at least another 3 million foreclosures next year.
So a little bit less demand and a lot more supply because of foreclosures, we think, are a recipe for declining prices through the second quarter of next year.
Mortgage rates are already rising. They hit an all-time low of about 4.7% a few weeks ago. Freddie Mac predicts they'll reach 6% by the end of next year. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There are two kinds of security in aviation, the kind you see and the kind you don't. In the wake of that Christmas Day scare in Detroit, there is a lot more visible security out there right now. President Obama said in a statement today the government did, in fact, mishandle information it had received about the man who tried to blow up that flight. A systemic failure, the president called it. So what do you suppose is the systemic return on investment for checkpoint screeners and expensive high-tech scanners versus money that is spent on behind-the-scenes intelligence? That is the question we put to our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
At a relatively quiet Los Angeles International Airport today, traveler Howard Warman was reassured by the show of extra security.
It's not going to affect my travel plans. In fact, I'm happy about the restrictions.
The Transportation Security Administration has already spent $40 billion on aviation security. So if that's not enough to stop a lone crotch bomber, what is? Richard Bloom is a professor of terrorism and security studies at Arizona's Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. He doubts that focusing more on high-tech body scanners and explosive detectors will stand in the way of the most determined terrorists.
For the sophisticated ones, which have capabilities for surveillance, planning, intelligence collection, I am not optimistic technology would be a fix. The technical parameters of any particular piece of machinery are easy enough to plan against.
The TSA has long promised to focus its dollars in the direction of the biggest risk. But at the Libertarian Reason Foundation, Transportation Policy Director Richard Poole complains that's just lip service as long as the agency keeps treating all passengers the same.
Everybody is not equally likely to be a threat. And if we spend a huge amount of resources equally distributed across all travelers, we're going to waste a lot of money and we're not going to do enough on the guys that are really likely to be the bad guys.
Poole and other critics say the real waste comes from theatrics that just inconvenience travelers and harm the industry. Privacy advocate Bill Scannell.
Whenever we have a security incident, my first thought is not, oh my God, what happened? It's always, oh Lord, what are they going to do to us next? Because security theater is easy to impose. Actually stopping bad guys is very, very hard.
Which may explain why, back at LAX, the Reverend Roosevelt Miles was leaving his fate to a higher authority.
When it's my time, ain't nothing I can do to stop that, but I have faith in my God.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The corporate spat of this Tuesday is brought to us by Rupert Murdoch's News Corp and Time Warner, more accurately Fox Television and Time Warner Cable. Negotiations between the two over who's going to pay how much for Fox programming like American Idol and the National Football League are coming down to the wire. Fox says that unless a deal is made by Friday, it's going to pull the plug on Time Warner subscribers in some cities. Sounds fairly straightforward, but it is really about changing business models in the media business, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
The profit margin for broadcast networks is fairly thin. In a good year, it's around 10%. Derek Bain is an analyst with SNL Kagan.
It's just not a really good business model.
Cable networks have fatter profit margins, 4 to 5 times more lucrative. With advertising revenue down and broadcasters paying millions to develop shows, Bain says the networks want cable companies to help foot the bill.
They're trying to, you know, essentially shift the economics back to the broadcast network, which is providing the primetime programming.
Fox is demanding about 4 times what it currently gets from Time Warner. That's not out of character for Fox boss Rupert Murdoch. Michael Wolff wrote a biography of Murdoch called The Man Who Owns the News.
He won't capitulate. There's a certain lack of reason about Murdoch. It's certainly business reason. He can sustain more pain than anyone else, which is why he so often wins.
But analyst Derek Bain says cable providers risk alienating consumers if they raise rates.
You can't pass it on to the consumer. So, you know, either the cable operator is going to have to eat that, which is going to go into their margin, or they're going to have to refuse to carry it.
He expects Fox will ultimately secure higher rates, though less than it's asking for. Whatever increase Fox negotiates, analysts say the other networks will want similar deals, so we can expect more standoffs in the future. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
A note now to follow up on a broadcast from last week. I had mentioned that there were 28 billion shares of Citigroup outstanding, partly as a result of the government bailout. That is enough for every person on the planet to own slightly more than 4 Citigroup shares. The follow-up question was, what other 4 companies have enough shares to let all 6 billion some odd of us own at least one of them? The somewhat delayed answer is General Electric, Bank of America, Microsoft, and interestingly, Pfizer. I didn't see that one coming. Those companies and more were bought and sold on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you believe the recession is actually over, as no less a luminary than Ben Bernanke has told us, there is still that small matter of millions of lost jobs to deal with. The prospect of a growing economy without a comparable increase in employment has given rise to a phrase you might have seen or heard recently, the phenomenon of a jobless recovery. We've got our entrepreneurship reporter Mitchell Hartman on the line to look back at the labor market that was this past year. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, Kai.
So for most of this past year, it has been a horrible recession and a horrible job market together, right? But that is changing a little bit.
It's changing in terms of economic growth, at least as of the last several months. But it's not really changing in terms of jobs. We've kept losing tens of thousands of jobs month after month, even as the economy officially went into expansion mode again a few months ago. Now, that situation has improved steadily to where in November we lost a measly 11,000 jobs. But that means that there's a sort of a disconnect between economists. They're crunching the numbers and saying, hey, look, there's growth again. And politicians who are looking at the dismal state of employment, and what they are saying is the recession's actually not really over for working people.
Okay, but as you mentioned, we are at least creating some jobs, which means some people are getting hired, yes?
Well, someone's getting hired, but the problem is it's largely not the people who have been unemployed the longest, and that is one of the real problems as we go into next year. The number of people who are long-term unemployed, this means they're 6 months or more on the job market and still looking, is higher than in previous recessions. And it could take these people, in some cases, decades to regain their economic footing.
Break it down for us, though, Mitchell. I mean, who are we talking about? What's it really like?
I did a series on unemployment earlier this year. We were focusing on states with high unemployment. I did a quick check back with some of the people I had spoken with. So these were unemployed people. They included welders, some textile workers. There was a marketing executive, some people in computer programming. In 6 months, none of these people has found full-time work. You know, it's a buyer's market for employers right now. There's no doubt about it. I talked to Marianne Moore about this. She has an employment agency in Portland, and she deals with a lot of small businesses.
They think that they've got the tiger by the tail. They're trying to pay lower. They're trying to get more work. If you want to get a job right now, if you're flexible, that's going to be it. Somebody who will answer the phones, do filing, do accounting. I mean, they're trying to pigeonhole four jobs into one and pay less.
So Marianne Moore complains about this, right? It makes it more difficult for her to place workers. And yet she's got a receptionist, and that person doubles as her bookkeeper. So she's doing this too.
Let me put you on the spot here for a second, Mitchell, and ask you when you think the job situation might actually get better.
Well, we'll probably be having a little bit of job growth early in 2010, and there's some encouraging signs that it'll steadily increase. People are working more hours. Temp work is up, and that's what's seen as a leading economic indicator. Basically, it means permanent hires are down the road at some point. Again, Marianne Moore is seeing this with her agency's clients.
People are wanting to hold on to their pennies, and they're trying not to spend any money, so they're running their staff ragged right now. And that's why we've seen a pickup in direct hires, because they'll agree to have a temp, and then all of a sudden they'll be like, you know what, this is working well, and we can afford it, so we'll keep the person.
And this is exactly what economists say is happening across the economy. It has to happen a lot more to replace the 11 million jobs that we're now in the hole for since the recession began. Now, the president wants to pump some adrenaline into this hiring machine. He's talking about more money for roads and bridges, for small business tax breaks to encourage them to hire new workers. The problem, according to a lot of small business owners that I've talked to, is that if they don't have new business, if the economy doesn't improve quite a bit, they're not going to hire new workers, however much of a tax break they get.
Thus, the jobless recovery. Mitchell Hartman at the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk up at Oregon Public Broadcasting. Mitchell, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Kai.
About halfway through the 2009 holiday marathon, Christmas behind us, New Year's just a couple of days away, which prompts one to ask whether you've bought your champagne yet. If you have, you would be among the minority, because along with the rest of the economy, the industry has lost a lot of its fizz the past couple of years, and Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports that has created a bubble of its own.
I'm not going to do a story about champagne without actually tasting some, so I invited wine writer and blogger Alice Firing down to a Manhattan restaurant called Balthazar. We started by talking about the way things used to be. The year was 2007, the stock market was up, unemployment was down, and there were a lot of corks a-popping.
The champagne industry finally had arrived. They were complaining there wasn't enough champagne for the world.
Then, as you can probably guess, the bottom fell out of the champagne market. And these days, Firing says, some champagne is going back to France, where it came from.
They actually had to send some back.
Send some back because they were taking up too much room in the warehouses.
Firing says sales are down between 50 and 90% from the peak. And come Thursday night, she says, many Americans won't be clinking glasses of the good stuff.
If you're going to be having a small, intimate dinner, I would bet money on it that you would hear that pop, and that pop is going to be champagne. If you're going to have 15 people or more, it's going to be some semblance of sparkling wine.
Ah, sparkling wine, the cheap cousin of champagne, not grown in the region with the same name. In France, it's called Cremant. In Spain, it's called Cava. In California, it's called sparkling wine. And in Italy, it's called Prosecco.
Champagne is going to stop you. Oh, my God, this makes me so happy. Prosecco is we need bubbles, and it's got to be cheap.
Not far from Balthazar, you can see the Prosecco craze firsthand. Astor Wines and Spirits is one of the sparkling wine hubs of New York, and Lorena Asensios is the wine buyer there.
People still want sparkling wine, but they can't afford to spend, you know, $40, $50, $60 for a great bottle of champagne.
So instead, she says, they're buying Prosecco.
It is a sparkling wine, not as full sparkling as a true champagne. It is more accessible, it's not as rich, but it's very, very drinkable and very affordable. You can get great Prosecco. We have one for $6.99. It's one of our best sellers.
What's the difference? Well, I had a taste test with Alice Firing back at Balthazar. Wisely, she started me off with the non-champagne bubbly. It tastes pretty good.
It's bubbly. It's bubbly. It's grapey.
As for the actual champagne?
It has way more finesse. It's got less headache produce. They're going to hate me.
While we were tasting, diner Evelyn Scoroshode walked over to offer her thoughts.
I came from Paris, and I drink a lot of champagne.
And to put it mildly, she does not approve of the world's newfound appetite for Prosecco.
I mean, Prosecco is a little bit of fashionables, and because it's less expensive, and people just buy bubbles without the taste of champagne, and believe me, it's completely different.
Well, come on, it's not that bad. And consumers certainly seem to like it. When the sales figures for champagne's busiest season come out in February, it's likely Americans will be telling producers what Ella Fitzgerald and others have been singing for decades.
I get no kick from champagne.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
So tell me, why should it be true that I get a kick out of you? Some get a kick.
Coming up, come one, come all to the film festival circuit.
The film festival is an opportunity to start to cultivate interest in you and your films, and presumably you're an artist.
I am.
You're an artist.
Now.
But first, let's do the numbers. Another sluggish trading day today. Markets stood still when the bell rang. The Dow Industrials lost a point, closing virtually flat at 10,545. The NASDAQ filed off 2 points, a tenth of 1%, ended at 2,288. The S&P 500 parted with a point, also a tenth percent, finished at 1,126. ExxonMobil trickled down a third, Chevron 0.2%. The price of oil rose slightly on cold weather and expectations that weekly data might show another fall in U.S. oil inventories. Walt Disney picked up 1.5% today. Microsoft padded up 0.2%. 3M glued on 0.8%. But Apple bit off more than 1%. Its competitor Nokia said it had filed a patent complaint against Apple with the International Trade Commission. The 10-year T-note rose. The yield thus fell to 3.81%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Why is a derivative like a Thanksgiving turkey? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify the worlds of finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org. The trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. President Obama is scheduled to continue his vacation in Hawaii. Only a couple of days remain to choose your New Year's resolutions for 2010. Save money, manage debt, and lose weight are on the list of popular resolutions at USA.gov. And what's behind door number one? Let's Make a Deal, the television game show people really dressed up for, debuted on December 30th, 1963. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There has been no shortage of truly big economic stories this year. Healthcare reform, climate change, and the Great Recession, we got them all. But there was also a whole bunch of news that didn't quite make the headlines. We've been asking our regulars to muse on some of those. Here's commentator and sports writer John Wertheim's nomination.
The NFL is by far the biggest American sports league. It generates billions in television revenue, and if you need more evidence, just look to the unchecked growth of the Super Bowl. The proof is abundant. Pro football is the king of American sports. And because of that, the most important sports business story is going to be about football. I know what you're thinking. It's got to be about the tumultuous season of the Washington Redskins and the fact that the fans were near revolt in D.C. Nope. So it's got to be about the return of Brett Favre to the NFL and to the Minnesota Vikings, no less. Not that either. I'll give you a hint. It has to do with a Terminator, a billionaire developer, and a city filled with angels. In late October, with surprisingly little fanfare, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed a bill to allow a proposed L.A. football stadium to sidestep environmental laws. With that stroke of the pen, the door opened wide for the NFL to return to Los Angeles after more than 15 years away. This carries all sorts of implications. More leverage for the NFL in the next round of television negotiations, a new wrinkle for the upcoming collective bargaining talks with the players' union. But above all, a team in L.A. presents a new opportunity to get football in front of Latinos in a big way. They're America's fastest growing demographic, and collectively, the ethnic group with the most purchasing power, what with their $750 billion in personal income. Baseball, soccer, even basketball have courted a wide swath of fans. But for all the NFL's success in recent years, it's had a hard time expanding what the sports marketing types call the demographic footprint. Go to an NFL game and conspicuously the crowd is more befitting of a NASCAR race than, say, an MLS soccer game. Hispanics in particular have been an elusive audience. As one Latin columnist recently put it, the NFL's effort to reach the Hispanic market has resembled someone, quote, blindfolded, spun around in circles, and told to hit a piñata with one hand tied behind its back. Sports passions and loyalties take time to gestate. But a new stadium, and consequently a new NFL team in Los Angeles, will go a long way toward helping football rival football as the world's game.
John Wertheim is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. His most recent book is called Strokes of Genius. Share your thoughts with us. Our website is marketplace.org. There's a link up in the top right corner of that page that says Contact. Sundance and Cannes get all the press, but the film festival circuit is pretty much a year-round operation. This week, for instance, you could go to Italy for the Capri Hollywood International Film Festival. There's one in Manila, the Philippines, in full swing right now. Next week, it's Palm Springs, California. Sadly, we just missed the one up in Anchorage, Alaska, with what has to be the all-time best festival slogan ever. Films, they say, worth freezing for. Most of what you're going to find on the festival circuit are smaller, lower-budget, more independent films, which is where Cash Peters comes in.
So here's what happened. I decided to produce a short film. I mean, you can't stay in radio forever, right? Plus, I've heard independent movies can make a bundle if they sell at film festivals. Well, yes and no. According to Rebecca Yeldum, she made the Kite Runner movie and now runs the LA Film Festival. That used to be the case.
What happened was this kind of very seductive carrot got dangled in front of artists. You know, become a filmmaker, go to Sundance, get in competition, win a prize, and sell your movie for a $10 million advance. Like, that was a very kind of sexy concept.
And it still is, because that's exactly what I want, $10 million. Unfortunately, so does everyone else, apparently. Trevor Groth runs the Cine Vegas Film Festival.
Movie making has opened up to the masses, and you have a huge range now of the kind of films that are made.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean you want to see them, what they produce, though. I mean, you must get a huge amount of garbage.
Well, one man's garbage is another man's.
Oh, you're way too forgiving.
No, of course, of course.
Of course. But here's the thing. Cameras are so cheap these days, and it only costs about $50 to enter a festival, so suddenly the entire world and his wife now think they're Michael Moore. Trouble is, unless you really are Michael Moore, the festival circuit can be a real dead end, especially in this economy when so few movies get picked up. This year's LA Film Festival, for instance, had 4,000 entries, all competing for a $50,000 grand prize, and, most importantly, a movie deal.
The cold, hard truth is that probably 1% of those films will ever see, if that, will ever see any kind of meaningful theatrical distribution. That's the reality of our world and the marketplace for specialty film.
So, bearing all that in mind, and with my eye on 50 grand, I decided to give it a shot and make my own movie. Passion is important, of course, so I chose a subject I'm incredibly passionate about, myself, and took it to Rebecca Yeldham.
The film festival is an opportunity to start to cultivate interest in you and your films, and presumably you're an artist.
I am.
You're an artist.
Now.
And you had a story to tell, and maybe there'll be other people in the cinema who might be able to see your incredible talent and are going to want to then give you other opportunities in the future.
So can I show you my movie?
Absolutely.
It's really short.
Okay.
But it's great.
Excellent.
As for today, I'm doing the master cleanse to clean out my body.
Wow. Could this be more exciting? Here I was showing my new movie to the producer of The Kite Runner. It's an unusual piece. It's mainly about me dieting. I don't know what it was about this concept that repulsed Rebecca so much, but she didn't like it at all.
It's a weird kind of infomercial
For me.
For you.
So there you go. That's what I'm entering into your film festival.
I'm sorry. With all due respect, I haven't got a chance in hell.
Why is that?
It's not very good.
Clearly, I'm not Michael Moore. And I'm guessing you're not either. Unless you are. But hey, my movie was shown in 3 major film festivals across the country. And you know what? I even sensed Rebecca coming around in the end.
For 10 days, you consume nothing but maple syrup, lemonade, cayenne pepper, and tea.
How would you compare this to The Kite Runner, maybe?
I think that you fall a little short.
Yeah, well, all right, she hated it. In Hollywood, film capital of the world, for some, I'm Cash Peters for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, we have deliberately stayed away from the Tiger Woods story since it broke. We have done just one item, I think, because once you say, gee, his sponsors are going to be angry about this, how much more of a business and economic angle can there really be? Well, thanks to 2 economics professors at the University of California, Davis, a whole bunch of angles. They compared the stock values of companies Woods endorses versus those he doesn't. They say shareholders in Woods-endorsed companies lost anywhere from $5 to $12 billion in value in the 13 trading days after news of Tiger's transgressions broke. So there you have it. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday. Today, the Dow dropped a point, basically flat. The Nasdaq shaved off 2 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 also lost a point, 0.1%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time, 6 months ago, Times Square in New York City became a pedestrian mall. Now?
The street is meant for cars, not for people. And the city's busy. There's a lot of traffic. I know Mayor Bloomberg wants to see us all riding bicycles, but, you know, that's not reality.
Forget about it. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening
because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.